Well, I'm going to risk being Captain Obvious here and say that Christmas is a really big deal in our culture. It's estimated that at least 2 billion people celebrate Christmas every year. About 35 million Americans have a Christmas tree. How many of you have one? You can raise your hands. That's not awkward. In their home with presents packed underneath. The average American family in America spends nearly $1,000 on presents, give or take a few hundred bucks, which pushes consumer spending to almost $1 trillion in America alone for the Christmas holiday. Every year, more movies are made about Christmas. We just watched one yesterday. We can talk about that later, whether or not you should go watch it or not yourselves. More movies are made every year. More books are written every year. More songs are written every year. Christmas is the largest and arguably the most popular holiday celebrated on the planet. The question is why? Why is it such a big deal? Why do we love it so much? What makes it so important? And I want to look at what the answer to that is. Why is Christmas such a big deal? I think it's because Christmas points to our reason to have joy and our longing to experience abiding joy. Beneath all of the cheer and the tinsel and the lights is a birth story. It's the story of the birth of Jesus Christ, the birth of joy. So what we're going to do this morning is we're going to follow the trail back to the one who really got the party started, okay? The one all the songs kind of preview about and the ones that our culture can hint at but have trouble identifying. We're going to go back to the source of our hope and joy. It is Christ. So we're going to look at the Lord Jesus, the Christmas child, and I think we're going to find, hopefully, that Christmas is not a big enough deal. I think it should be a lot bigger of a deal when you look at the actual story and how beautiful it actually is. So the way we're going to look at Jesus this morning is we're going to listen to the words of Isaiah, the prophet, in Isaiah chapter 9. Katie, thank you for sharing. She read it, did a great job. We're going to look at the story of the birth of the prophecy of Jesus in the book of Isaiah chapter 9. And we're going to follow what was predicted about Jesus nearly 3,000 years ago. Isaiah 9 is a prophecy, and prophecies would bring good news in some situations, and it would also bring bad news. This is a prophecy of good news, really, really good news. However, the story starts off as somewhat of a downer in Isaiah 9. Things don't look good in the world. There's upheaval, there's battles, there's war, there's conflict. God's people, Israel, are in battles with surrounding nations, which is still happening today. They're confused about their purpose in the world. They don't know up from down. And the nations they are fighting don't know their purpose in the world either. So there was battling each other, and there was an obsession over who is right and wrong, and nobody is happy, all right? Maybe that sounds a little bit like your family this Christmas. I don't know. I hope not. But that's how it was here before this prophecy was given. There was battling. There was conflict. There was a lack of hope. There was a lack of peace, a lack of joy. But then something unexpected happened. An important word is introduced into the story. It's the word, it's the conjunction but. So the word but is a conjunction that separates two ideas. So for example, I might say my ankle hurts, but I'm going to go for a walk anyway. Or I don't really feel like cooking, but I'm going to cook a turkey because I'm supposed to do that. So the word but changes the focus from one thing to something else. It redirects the attention. You're thinking about one thing, then you think about something else. That's what's about to happen here. So we're going to pick it up in verse 1. We're going to walk through the story together. And here's how it starts. It says this in verse 1, but there will be no gloom for her who was in anguish. I'll read the rest of it. In the former time, he brought into contempt the land of Zebulun and the land of Naphtali. But in the latter time, he has made glorious the way of the sea, the land beyond the Jordan, Galilee of the nations. So the upheaval and the chaos of the world is about to meet a conjunction, a turning. God is going to stop the world from going one way to another way, to turn the attention of the world to something else. What he's going to do here is he's going to show us the kind of God he is. He's not a sideline coach. He's not a critic. He doesn't look down from heaven like, oh, you people don't know what you're doing. Good luck with that. No, he engages his planet. He engages his world. He doesn't just watch from the sidelines. He's not a critic of the world. He's a redeemer of the world. Very different. He engages trouble, engages chaos, engages the disorder of the world. And so don't rule God out of your life. Don't get too worried about the first part of the sentence, like my life is a wreck, or I've made too many bad decisions, I'm irredeemable, or I'm too messed up to get things together again. Don't put a period where there should be a comma. That's what Isaiah 9 is getting at. Don't put a period where there should be a comma. You know, when I was younger, I had no problem starting a movie and finishing it. It was easy. I could watch many movies by myself and finish the movies. Nowadays, like Melanie and I, we start a movie, and it might take 3 months to finish it. We have no time to go finish a two-hour movie. It just doesn't happen. That's why Netflix has nice 50-minute little episode shows. That's what we watch. 50 minutes works for us. But here's the deal. If your life has hit a tough time, don't lose hope. Like that could be a pause, but hit play again. The movie's not over yet. Go back to it. Hit play again. Let it finish, because the Lord is not done writing that story. He's not done with you yet. Don't put a period where there should be a comma. So God will come here in Isaiah 9. He will invade the darkness in Isaiah 9, and he will put into it a burst of hope. He will provide us with three things here. First off, he's going to give us light. Verse 2 says this. See the screen here. The people who walked in darkness have seen a great light. Those who dwelt in a land of deep darkness, on them a light has shone. Now, this may come as a surprise to you, but everyone in the world is walking in darkness. Everybody, without exception. I know it doesn't seem like that when you watch the Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade. And so, I don't know if you watch that or not. Maybe you do, maybe you don't. Or if you've seen like the lighting of the tree in Rockefeller Plaza in Manhattan and New York City. It looks so beautiful and so colorful, but the hints of light and brightness are shallow. They really are. They're shallow and they're temporary. Everyone is walking in darkness, and even worse, everyone is dwelling in darkness. This means that we don't just pass through the land of darkness like you drive through a town, and you get through the town and you go to the other side. No, we dwell in it. We live in it. We inhabit it. It's become normal for us. Darkness is normal for us, and there's no escaping it. You know, we've had a lot of overcast skies earlier in the week. Did you notice that? Very gray skies. In fact, the month of November is over half overcast. And you probably know that as well. Big surprise, right? But this is how the world is spiritually. There's an overcast over our hearts. Except the overcast is total. The sun never shines. We dwell, we walk in deep darkness all the time. There's nothing we can do to change it. Why? Because the problem isn't the weather out there. It's the weather in here. It's the overcast in the heart. It's the darkness in the heart. It's the cold in the heart. Ephesians 5, 8 to 9 makes it clear how bad it really is, where Paul says this, of those who, before they found Jesus, or Jesus found them, he says this, for at one time you were darkness. That's a whole different level, isn't it? You were darkness. So the problem is not our job. It's not our family. It's not our government. The problem is us. We dwell in darkness. We walk in darkness. And we are darkness. Now, I'm not trying to depress everyone on December 1st before Christmas. I'm just saying this is what the Bible teaches. And we have to understand this foundation before we can really take in the good news that Jesus has come. Accept and embrace. This is the state of humanity apart from the redeeming work of God. I'm trying to lay a foundation for what comes next, because God doesn't leave us in darkness. He doesn't leave us in that state. He penetrates that darkness with light. Where he says, those who have walked in darkness have seen a great light. On them, a light has come and shone. Now, seeing something is relatively painless and effortless. It doesn't take a tremendous amount of effort for me to see you all right now. I'm not like, I got to get my eyes a break. This is a lot of work for me. It doesn't really take a lot of work. I just see you. And in the same way, being shined on doesn't tire me out either. The sun comes out, the sun is shining, it actually brings energy. and it fills the room with light. And I don't have the thought, I'm too tired to have the sun shine on me. This is wearing me out. No, it's the opposite, right? It's actually giving us energy. Well, seeing something and being shined on do not require much effort. It just happens. And that's what Jesus is doing here. He's coming to shine on you, his light. He's coming to show himself so you can see him. And when you've lived in darkness for a long time, there's nothing like seeing the sun. In fact, just a couple days ago, Melanie commented, the sun broke, and she's like, the sun, it's here, it's here. It's a beautiful thing. There's nothing like it. And so don't get too down. If you're feeling overcast right now, if your life is just feeling heavy and it's cloudy, it's okay. Hang in there. It makes the sun that much more brilliant and that much more beautiful. Not when, or not if, but when Jesus comes. And that's what Jesus is going to do here. He's going to shine his light. But it doesn't end there. God will give us light, and God will give us joy. Verse 3, you have multiplied the nation. You have increased its joy. They rejoice before you as with joy at the harvest, as they are glad when they divide the spoil. You hear the theme there four times. I put them in green because it's Christmas and I can do that. Four times the word joy or gladness is mentioned in one verse. Look at the contrast. It's gone from gloom and anguish and darkness to now joy and gladness. Well, what does that mean? What exactly is joy? When we sing Joy to the World, like we just sang, thank you for picking that, Thomas. What are we talking about? What are we singing about? What is joy? Well, joy, I mean, there's a lot of ways to define joy. But joy, we know for sure, it does not come from a change of outward circumstances. Joy comes from a change of relational status. It comes from within. The joy comes through having a good relationship with God through Christ. You know that nothing drains joy like relational conflict. Nothing drains joy worse than being in some kind of a relational tussle with someone. You know, if you're married and have recently gotten into a lively disagreement, I know that never happens in our church community, but just imagine, you got into a lively disagreement with a family member. Probably the last thing you were thinking was, this is fun. I feel so joyful right now. You probably weren't feeling that, right? You were feeling down. You were feeling distressed. You're feeling like, when are we going to get out of this tunnel? This is hard. Relational conflict is super difficult. Or if you're in a legal dispute with someone or going through a relational rift with a family member or a friend, it doesn't make you happy. Nothing drains our joy like relational conflict, and nothing gives our joy back like having relationships healed. When our relationship with God is healed, the joy comes back. And without that relationship mended, we can't experience full joy. You know, we're born with boxing gloves on our little tiny hands. And there's really one person we have a beef with. It's God. It's God we want to take on. We want to fight him. We want to argue with him. We disagree with the way he's doing it. And it creates all kinds of conflict, and it robs our joy. So God, what he did is he set out to restore this torn relationship with him. That's where all relational health comes from. So that joy can come rushing back in. You know, joy is something hard to describe, but you know it when you have it. You know what I'm talking about? You know it when you experience it. And when I was 19, I've had a few moments in my life where I've just had like this sort of surge of joy, and it's only been a handful of times. And I have joy in general, but some special times that I've had it. And one time when I was 19 years old, and I'd spent some time in Tanzania, Africa, with a friend of mine and with some folks that I travel with from Indiana. And my friend and I visited a missionary there in a town called Moshi, kind of not too far from the foothills of Mount Kilimanjaro. Just think Lion King, and that's basically what Moshi was. But the whole week in Moshi, I just felt this heaviness, this distress, this kind of darkness. And I don't know what all it was. I really don't know what all it was. It was just a sense of not belonging there. And I still don't know exactly what was happening there in my experience in Moshi as a 19-year-old. But I do remember at the end of the week, we got dropped off at the bus station, me and my buddy Matt. And we bought our tickets. And we boarded our bus to the east coast of Africa to go on a little three-week adventure. And I remember just that feeling, just a rush of something I can only describe as joy. I didn't know where we were going. I didn't know what we were doing. I knew we had to be back in Kampala, Uganda in 3 weeks to fly out to get back to Minneapolis. But all I knew is that the burden was gone. And I think that's what joy feels like. It's at least in part having a light heart. Feeling free, feeling unburdened. And so joy is deeply linked to a removal of burdens. And that's the third thing that God came to give. He came to give us freedom from burdens. Verses 4 and 5 say this, "For the yoke of his burden and the staff for his shoulder, the rod of his oppressor you have broken, as on the day of Midian. For every boot of the tramping warrior in battle tumult and every garment rolled in blood will be burned as fuel for the fire." The imagery here is of an animal with a yoke on its back. A yoke was a curved piece of wood that connected two animals together so that they would work the fields and that they would plod along and work together on one piece of land. It was heavy, and it ensured that these cattle did what they were supposed to do. Burdens are meant to confine. They're meant to restrict. They're meant to limit freedom. That's the point of what an actual yoke or a burden was. Now, no one walked in carrying one of those on their shoulder, I don't think today, that I noticed. You know, we don't have physical burdens quite like that. Usually, some of us maybe do, but usually we don't. But all of us carry burdens at one time or another in our life. We're afflicted. We're weighed down. Could be emotional, relational, spiritual, maybe physical. But we're afflicted by various things like sickness and emotional trauma and the loss of a job, some form of personal tragedy and loss. Right? We all feel burdened. To live is to undergo burdens. We can't live without feeling at some point burdened and weighed down. And God doesn't necessarily remove all of those burdens immediately. But what God does right now is he removes the greatest burden that we have. He removes the burden of sin and death, the burden of not being good enough, and the burden of not doing good enough. He removes from us all the pressure to just nail it in life every single day with every single person in every situation, to be perfect, to have a perfect bank account, to have a perfect past, a perfect present, a perfect future, a perfect Thanksgiving, a perfect Christmas, just perfection. We all feel that pressure that we got to live up to this standard that no one has ever lived up to except for Jesus, of course. But we feel the pressure to do it, and we got to do it. And it's a lot to take on. You know, one of the biggest burdens that we have is to not have any more burdens. You ever had that burden? That's a bad one. Ooh, that one's twisted. That'll mess with you. What I mean is this. Do you ever get stressed out by your stress? Do you ever freak out because you're freaking out? Are you ever bummed out because you're so bummed out? This is where burdens get multiplied, because here's the deal. I think this is actually a good God-given thing. We feel that life shouldn't be like this, that it should be better. And so we're burdened with the expectation that life should be better than it is. That's a burden. You know, so maybe your Thanksgiving was not awesome and you were sad, but now you're sad that you were sad on Thanksgiving. And to zoom out even farther, you're sad that you're sad about being sad on Thanksgiving. I mean, the point is, it doesn't matter. Burdens are nebulous sometimes. They're confusing sometimes. It's the pressure for things to be better than they are, and we all feel that. This makes the invitation all the sweeter that Jesus gave. "Come to me, all who are weary and heavy laden." Remember this? "And I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you. Take my burden upon you. It's easy. It's light." I think Eugene Peterson, his translation of the Bible, I think the way he put it was, "It's fitted for your shoulders. I'll give you a burden that fits you. That's not too much to bear. Like lifting the right amount of weights that make you strong without hurting your muscles in the process or damaging you." He'll give you that type of burden, or the good type of well-fitted burden. Verse 6 tells us about this burden-lifting baby. Here's what it says. "For to us a child is born, to us a son is given, And the government shall be upon his shoulder. His name shall be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. So let's look at a few things about this coming child. First off, the child is born to us. There's a little more holiday green. To us. This means that the Christmas story is not just a distant historical event. It's for you. Its message is for you. Jesus was born for you. Unto you is born this day. So if you're in this room right now, and if you put your finger up to your neck and you feel a pulse, Christmas is for you. Jesus was born unto you, for you. Now, this may sound a bit anticlimactic. You know, a child is born unto me. Is that really what the world needs right now, a child? Like, what's a child going to do for me in my life? Well, yes, this is exactly what the world needs, because this won't be your typical baby. And when our sons were born, if you have kids, maybe you can relate to this, we called them things like sweet and adorable and cute and perfect. We didn't call them what they call Jesus. We didn't call them Mighty God, Wonderful Counselor, Prince of Peace. No, of course not. They're human babies. This was the God-man. Jesus came to do things that no one else has ever done. His name shall be called Counselor, God, Father, Prince of Peace. So let's look at that first name, Wonderful Counselor. Now notice what it doesn't say. It does not say a Wonderful Counselor. It says Wonderful Counselor. He's not just one of many counselors. He's the one and only. There's no one like him. He's the one and only. It's not something he does only. It's someone he is. And so the literal meaning of counselor is the one who plans. But this counselor will not just plan your life according to his wisdom and knowledge. He will also lead you through his plans. So he says, okay, here's your plan. I'm going to go with you in this plan. I'm with you in it. I'm not just going to send it to you or hand it to you and say, good luck, go get them, tiger, right? Tigers. He's not going to do that. He's going to set out the plan for you and then walk with you in it. Be his counselor who guides you. And so he sets out the course of your life, and then he comforts and guides you along that path. Only Jesus can do this. You know, I've had and continue to have some incredible counselors, coaches, mentors, leaders that have helped me in my life that I value so much and I'm so grateful for. And I've tried to guide people. Occasionally people come looking for some counsel from me. I love that. I feel honored to do that. I love bringing Jesus into that space and be like, let's talk about this. And I've been honored to provide counsel for people. However, all counseling is meant to lead us to the counselor, the all-knowing, all-powerful one, God, all-wise God. He maps out our life, and then he guides us through our life with his steady hand. Sometimes this may be a rocky path, a path that maybe we don't expect. But in the temptation at times can be to try to escape the course that Jesus has given you. Be like, okay, well, you know what? You're not that good of a counselor, right? Like, this isn't the path anymore. Something got goofed up. It's easy to assume that problems and hardships in your life are signs that God is not with you. That's a huge temptation. Things are bad. God must have left me. According to Psalm 23, that's not true. Because Psalm 23 says this, even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, guess what? Bottom line, you're with me. You comfort me. He doesn't take his hands off the wheel. And here's the deal. Our scenery in our life will change. It will change. It will go dark. It will be bright. It will be beautiful. It will be difficult. All kinds of scenery. One shepherd leading you. One Lord leading you. One counselor guiding you. Now and always. He's working all things for your good. But in case you get the image of Jesus, with a sofa, like kind of the stereotypical counselor, which isn't actually accurate. But in case that doesn't quite resonate with you as much, his names don't stop there. He's called Mighty God and Everlasting Father. Again, there is not an A before Mighty God. He's not a Mighty God among many. He is Mighty God, the one and only. He doesn't just hope things work out for you in your life. He is mighty God who sees to it that everything does work out according to his plan. And if and when you are weak, he will be strong. The baby child will also be an everlasting father. Now, this should make you turn your head a little bit, because if you were like me, you grew up hearing that Jesus was the Son of God, not the Father. What's going on? How is Jesus a Father, an everlasting Father? And if you didn't wonder that, now you can wonder that, and we'll answer all the same shot. So there you go. Perfect. Well, what's going on there? Well, when Jesus came as a baby, what he did is he represented God perfectly. He worked in tandem perfectly with the Father. So when you saw the Son, you saw the Father. If you want to get to know the Father, you see the Son. They worked hand in hand. They always worked together to accomplish the same mission. John 5:43 says, I come in my Father's name. John 10:30, I and the Father are one. John 14:9, whoever has seen me, you've seen the Father. John 14:11, believe me that I am in the Father and the Father is me, or else believe on account of the works themselves. Now, why does this matter? It matters because we don't ever have to wonder what God is like. Just open up the book of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, read about Jesus, and that's God. That's God. We don't have to wonder. He's shown us who he is. If you wonder who is God, go to the Bible. You'll see who God is. Exact representation of the Father. It matters because we'll have questions come up, like, what does God think of social outcasts and misfits? He loves them. He loves them like crazy. He throws big parties for them. What does God think of our good works for him? He thinks they're totally worthless if they're not empowered by his grace. If they're not done in love for him, they're worthless. What does God think of our faith in him? Remember the Roman centurion or the centurion? He loves our faith. That's a good Christmas gift to give God. He loves our faith. It wows him. What does God think of our little concerns and worries? He knows them and he cares about them. He wants to hear about it. He wants to know about it. And he wants you to bring those concerns to him, no matter how small or big they are. What does God think of addictions and bad habits? He can work with it. He can work with it. Does God really love us and want us to be with him? Does he want to be with us? Well, he sent his son to die for us so that we could be with him now and forever. So the answer is, yes, he does. The son, Jesus, is the exact representation of God the Father. And he's not the big guy with the big beard determining who's been good and who's been bad, who deserves a gift, who doesn't. He's a father who gives his best to us and takes our worst from us. The son teaches us who the father is. Who is the father? He's a giver, not a taker. He has nothing that he needs from us. We receive from him all that he has to offer us. He's an everlasting father. He's always there. Lastly, this child will be called the Prince of Peace. This is where it's easy to get the wrong idea, because the kind of peace that Jesus will give will not be circumstantial. It won't be circumstantial. It's not the peace that comes from having a well-stocked fridge or 100% equity in your home. It's not that. Those are securities that come and go. Those are securities that come and go, and they're temporary. Instead, Jesus will bring you the kind of peace that stays with you when maybe the fridge isn't full or as full. And your home is underwater, figuratively or literally, one or the other. You can still have peace even in that moment. He says in John 14, Jesus says, peace I leave with you, my peace I give to you. I'm giving this gift to you. Receive this gift of peace. Not as the world gives do I give to you. Let not your heart be troubled, neither let them be afraid. Why not? Because Jesus is giving us the peace right now that we all crave. Peace with God. That no one can take away. A right relationship with God. Fellowship with our Creator King. The peace that knows from that really comes from knowing that everything is going to be okay. Everything is going to be okay. That's where peace begins. When we have peace with God, we can have peace with everything else. We can have peace with our bellies, our stomachs, peace with food, peace with our relationships. We can have peace with our past. You know, maybe you got to write that letter to your 17-year-old self and say, hey, peace to you, 17-year-old, right? You can have peace with your past. I've done this, by the way. You should give it a shot. 16-year-old, actually, is the letter I wrote to myself. We can have real peace. And I think if you're thinking, well, you know what, peace is for the future. When I get all these things in a row, if I had ducks, I would get all my ducks in a row and then I'll have peace. If you think like that, you're never going to get it. It's been born unto you today, right now. My peace I give to you, Jesus says. Don't wait for it. Don't wait for some future day and then I'll be able to receive peace. No, receive it today. Receive it right now. And once you receive it, you will experience peace that then spreads. How did Jesus do this? By taking into himself the penalty for our sins at the cross. At the cross, this incredible baby turned grown man, the Prince of Peace, the Wonderful Counselor, was strung up naked on a Roman cross and died. He received the wrath of God so that we could receive the peace of God. So that we could have hope, the hope that Katie talked about earlier. Hope that never dies, hope that is living, hope that is not based on any circumstance on this planet, but based on having right standing with God right now in heaven. So that's the story of Christmas. Does it sound good? Is it worth all the money people spend on it? Yes. Is it worth the Christmas holidays? Absolutely. Even though they don't get at really the true source of it. It's worth it though. But just remember, this month of December, the source of the hope, the center, the baby Jesus born unto you. Let's pray and take communion. God, thank you that we could, again, just hear you speak, Lord, through your word. You've shown us who you are, Lord, and I don't know if, I think a lot of our confusion just comes, God, from it's doubt and fear, and there's just so many cobwebs in the brain. At least in my brain, there sure are. But God, thank you that you gently stroke those back with your kind hand. And God, I do know, Lord, that you came to give us life and life abundant. And I know that many of us settle for way less than that. God, give us the determination that the Gentile centurion had. Give us the determination that the lady had who said, I'm like a dog at the table of the master. I'll just take the crumbs that Jesus gives. God, give us that kind of grit. Joy is not something to wait for. It's something to go after. Hope is not something to wait for, nor is peace. It's something to go after. And God, I pray that we would go after it. We would find the things in our life that rob our joy, that eclipse your glory, so that we can live abundantly free in you. That's our prayer for Christmas. That's my prayer for everyone in this room, Lord. Be with us now as we take communion together. In your name we pray. Amen.